Good afternoon, everyone. So nice to see you. The title of the talk this afternoon is Finding Your Teacher. Perhaps like me, some of you have been watching the Ken Burns series on PBS about Vietnam. And watching this, I have found it by turns horrifying, infuriating. Haunting. But I think the most dominant experience for me in watching this is just this field of compassion for everybody involved in this tragedy. Everybody, without exception. I think it was after Sunday night, I found myself thinking, what a terrible irony it is that it was through the Vietnam War that I would find my teacher. Had Thich Nhat Hanh not been exiled from Vietnam, I think it's quite unlikely that I would be sitting here today with you. So, I know for some of us who practice in the Tibetan tradition, again, these remarkable Tibetan teachers who come to the West certainly would not have come apart from the invasion of Tibet by the Chinese. So out of horrific things, other things can happen. Last week, some of us saw the film about Thich Nhat Hanh's life called Walk With Me. I was thinking back. I had been reading probably for about 20 years lots of material on Zen. That was the flavor of Buddhism that was most available in American culture in the 1960s and 70s, and probably even into the 80s. I remember a particularly beautiful book called Nine-Headed Dragon River. It's by Peter Matheson, and Peter Matheson is really a writer's writer. He's a beautiful writer, and it's the story of his journey with Zen and working with some of the early Zen teachers in the United States, Yasutani Roshi and Soen Roshi. And I was so attracted to the aesthetic of Zen, the spareness of Zen, the precision of the practice. It was very inspiring to me. And I didn't really appreciate that there was a different flavor between Chinese Zen and Korean Zen and Japanese Zen and the Zen that I would encounter in the person of Thich Nhat Hanh, of this Vietnamese Zen, which is it's a softer Zen, if you will. It's influenced by the Theravadan practice, which influences us here in this place. I was trying to remember what year I came across Thich Nhat Hanh. I really can't remember now. But looking at the books on my bookshelf, it looks like it was about 21 years ago that I started reading Thich Nhat Hanh. And it began with a book that Kathy gave me for Christmas. It was called Living Buddha, Living Christ. And in the fall of 2000, I decided to stop just reading about Buddhism and sitting with the National Zen Group, but to go on retreat. And Thich Nhat Hanh at that time would come to the United States once or twice a year. So I went to meet him at a retreat at Mount Ascutney in Vermont. And the retreat was held in a tent which was at least as big as this space, if not bigger. There were probably 400 or 500 people who were there who had come to be with this diminutive Vietnamese monk. Immediately I was drawn into his Buddha field. His compassion, his lightheartedness, and the way that he has learned to meet the sorrows of his life and the sorrows of his country. I was especially attracted to the way that he would interact with children. He would invite young children to come up to the stage and be with him and ask him questions. And my favorite question, I've told this here before, a little girl asked him, "Why did you decide to become a monk?" And he said, "I thought it would be a lot of fun." Jim Forrest, a Christian who works for the Fellowship of Reconciliation, describes Thich Nhat Hanh as a cross between a caterpillar and a bulldozer. This is a great combination. A caterpillar, because he teaches this, you know, this slow Zen walking, and a bulldozer because he is so single-minded in his focus for peace and justice and compassion. I remember in the mornings we would get up for the first meditation of the day. It was still dark. Sun was just coming up. And we were walking in the wet grass, and the monks and the nuns would be leading us in these long lines coming into the tent, and you know, there was just this lifting and stepping and placing, lifting and swinging and placing, and the moon was up in the sky, and it was just it's just exquisite. Thich Nhat Hanh would say, "Walk as though you are kissing the earth with each step." What a different way of walking than the way most of us walk. He would also invite us, we've done this here before, but to look into our hands, just to look into the palm of our hands. And he'd say, if you look deeply into your hands, you can see your parents and your grandparents, and I actually remember one great-grandparent. And you can see all your ancestors. It's one of his signature practices, looking deeply and seeing how everything is made of everything else. Everything's made of everything. If you look deeply into this bell, you'll see the metal which was mined from the earth, but you also see the Burmese craftspeople who manufactured this bell. And Jimmy Pilkerton, who insisted that we have a bell which was had some heft to it. I think what really broke my heart open when I first sat with Thich Nhat Hanh was a practice called the five touchings of the earth. And he had everybody stand. You know, there were people were sitting on cushions or sitting in chairs, and he had everybody stand and to clear out a place so that we could make prostrations. And in these five prostrations, first you would bow to your parents and to your grandparents and to your ancestors, and you would simply lower your body to the ground so that you were prostrate out, and you would find your own words of gratitude for all their support and all their bringing you into this life, and for their difficulties and perhaps their sorrows and their failures. Acknowledging all these things. And then you would get back up, and then next you would prostrate and you would give thanks for all the people who had supported you in your life. All your dear friends and teachers. That whole cloud of witnesses who have held your hand in your life. Who have brought you to this day. And that would include the earth and the planet and everything that nourishes us and feeds us. And then we were invited to remember all the people who had constructed the things we use. The people who built this church after it burned down. People who build the homes in which we live, the hospitals which take care of us, the schools in which we're educated, the roads on which we drive, the sidewalks on which we walk. All these things that support our daily life that we just use but often don't see the whole chain of human creativity. Then we were invited to remember the little boy and the little girl inside of us. And to her sensitivity and his sensitivity and how easily we took in what was around us. The loving and the wounding. And we were invited to take in, to be aware of the little boy and the little girl of everyone around us. You can do that today. Take in the little boy and the little girl of everyone around you. And their confusion, our pain, our ignorance. And holding out the intention that this pain, this wounding, this ignorance finds healing, peace, reconciliation. And then finally, on the last prostration, we are invited to see that we were not only this little self, but we were the boundless source of peace and light, which could penetrate unfairness, cruelty, racism, discrimination. When we made contact with that larger reality that we all embody, there's a picture that I have. It's of Thomas Merton and Thich Nhat Hanh, and Merton has a famous essay called Not Hanh Is My Brother. Merton wrote this essay, and he was roundly criticized for it by the Catholic hierarchy for speaking out against the war in Vietnam. Thich Nhat Hanh had also spoken out against the Buddhist hierarchy in Vietnam. The Buddhist hierarchy at first was critical of his attempts to bring the monastery into the theater of the pain of the country. And so he and some of his fellow monks and nuns were sort of even in country, sort of exiled. I want to read you a couple little pieces. This is from a little book called Be Still and Know. It just pulls some excerpts out of Living Buddha, Living Christ. He says, to encounter a true master is worth a century of studying his or her teaching. To actually go and be in the physical presence of a true master is worth a century of reading books. In such a person, we have a living example of enlightenment, of freedom and peace. How can we encounter such a true master? It depends on us. Many who looked directly into the eyes of the Buddha or the eyes of Jesus were not capable of seeing them. When we see someone overflowing with love and understanding, someone who is deeply aware of what is going on, we know they are very close to the Buddha and to Jesus Christ. The enlightenment of the Buddha, the compassion and loving kindness of Jesus, grow every day. We ourselves are responsible for this growth. Our bodies are the continuation of the Buddha's body. Our compassion and understanding are the compassion and understanding of Jesus. He's saying, if you look deeply into your own hand, you'll see that you are the continuation of the Buddha. You are the continuation of the Christ. I knew when I was with him for the first time that I had never been around anyone like this. And I was so glad that I had stopped just reading books and had gone to be in his presence. The internet was younger at that point. I wonder if I would have gone. You know, so much is available now. So much great teaching material is available by way of the internet. But there is no substitution for the face-to-face encounter. There is a transmission of energy that happens in that space. I know some of you have said, something's different when I come to meditate here rather than when I just meditate alone. There is a transmission of energy. I pulled this book off the shelf after watching Ken Burns last night. This is his book called The Path of Emancipation. Looks like I read it right before I went to be with him in 2000. A Vietnam War veteran in America told me this story. When he was in Vietnam, he saw many of his friends killed in an ambush. He was so mad and vengeful that he decided to kill some people from the village where the ambush had taken place. He poisoned a bag of sandwiches, left them at the entrance to the village, and hid to watch. A group of children passed by and saw the sandwiches. They happily shared them. Once they had eaten them, they began to cry and say that they had been poisoned. Their parents tried to find a car to take them to the hospital, but the nearest hospital was far away. The GI knew that there was no hope and that the children would die. He had done a terrible thing out of anger, ill will, and vengeance. He had killed 5 children. After he was released from the army and returned home, he did not have any peace. He bore this wound within himself for 10 years. Then he came to a retreat in Santa Barbara that we offered to Vietnam veterans. The veterans were encouraged to speak of their suffering, though it was difficult for them to do so. Only one person, his mother, had heard this man's story. She had said, "Don't suffer too much, my son. In war, these things happen." But that did not help him. Every time he found himself sitting in a room with children, he could not bear it and had to leave. That day, with the strong support of the Sangha, monks, nuns, psychotherapists who work with war veterans, and other friends in the practice, he was able to tell the story to a group of about 9 people. Sometimes we had to sit and breathe for a long time, an hour or so, waiting for him to continue. He just sat and cried and was unable to say anything. After I heard the story, I invited him to my room. I said, "Dear friend, it's true that you killed 5 children. But there is something you can do to repair that. There are many children today who are dying from lack of food and medicine. 40,000 children die every day from starvation and malnutrition. Why don't you do something to save the dying children today instead of letting yourself be imprisoned by the memory of those 5 children? You have to begin anew. You have to use your life to do the opposite of what you have done in the past. Make a vow to receive the mindfulness trainings, and from now on, do your best to protect and save the lives of children. Go into the world and save the children. Why imprison yourself in guilt when you can repair the past?" The door was unlocked, beginning anew. We get powerful energy from the practice, the Sangha, and from our determination to follow the right path. It can wipe away the suffering of the past and transform our guilt. I was so struck when I first met Thich Nhat Hanh. He said that he, on the altar of his hermitage in Plum Village in France, had a statue of the Buddha and a statue of Jesus. And I thought, oh, this is the teacher for me. So he has this book called Living Buddha, Living Christ. And he has another book about Jesus and the Buddha. It's called Going Home, the Buddha and Jesus as Brothers. And there's a statement. The statement is this: "In the garden of my heart, the flowers of peace bloom beautifully. In the garden of my heart, the flowers of peace bloom beautifully." So we have had that inscribed on a stone, which sits in the memorial garden to Kathy that we're going to dedicate at St. Mary's on October 22nd. She loved that particular saying. I was looking through my treasure trove of Thich Nhat Hanh books, you know, like Merton. He's just such a prolific author. You know, Merton wrote over 40 books. Thich Nhat Hanh's written probably more than that. He has lived a lot longer than Merton. He's 91 years old now. But this particular book is called Fragrant Palm Leaves, and it's his journals from 1962 to 1966. During part of that time, he was a teaching assistant at Princeton and Columbia. And this particular book has the inscription, "Gordon, Merry Christmas to my wonderful teacher." It's from Jimmy Pilkerton. It's 1999. So I want to read you this passage. It's a little bit long, but I think it gives you a sense of his sensibilities and partly why he so attracted me as a teacher. So he's in New York City. He's gone to the Buddhist Pure Land Temple on Riverside Drive. And he says, and so there's a sermon that sort of happens in this temple, and he says, "I didn't find the sermon very inspiring." How many sermons have you found not very inspiring? I'm afraid I've preached a few of those myself. So So he says, after the sermon, there was a koto concert. To me, the koto player more than made up for the lackluster sermon. Koto is a Japanese instrument. Pure Land folks are largely Japanese. I sat between two Americans who looked rather distracted during the sermon, but obviously enjoyed the music. I, too, enjoyed the music. The musician's name was Kimioto Eto, a young, around 30-year-old man with a kind and open face. Dressed in a black kimono, he slowly mounted the stage, led by a young man gently guiding his arm. I wondered if he had poor eyesight. After Reverend Seiki introduced him, Eto slowly sat down and smiled quietly. I was deeply touched by his presence. He never looked at the audience, but settled his gaze on the podium that was draped with a white cloth. His smile was calm and composed. I never imagined a smile like that was possible in this country. He said he wished to dedicate his playing to Kanzion, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, to commemorate the 70th anniversary of Buddhism in America. He explained that the number 7 had deep personal significance for him. His father had died 7 years ago, and his mother had died 7 months ago. His eyes filled with tears, and his quiet face was intense with feeling. I detected elements of faith, memory, and sorrow in his face. He played songs that he had composed himself. The first was called Song of Hope. Though the melody was tinged with sadness and yearning, it also expressed endurance and the will to move forward. The second piece, Autumn Wind, was scented with the memory of loved ones. And the third, Language of Faith, expressed his devotion to the way of compassion. Each piece was followed by a long pause, during which I had the impression the audience stopped breathing and simply gazed at the young musician with a serene smile. At the end of the third piece, he mentioned that he was blind. Everyone seemed moved, and indeed, my whole being was touched. No one had guessed that he was blind. I wanted to weep. I stood up and left, and even though he had several more pieces to play, 3 beautiful pieces were enough for me. I walked slowly along Riverside Drive, feeling rather melancholy. I could still see his smile in my mind, so wondrously serene. No one could smile like that unless they had passed through great suffering. I understood why his smile had stirred me so deeply the moment I saw him. Riverside Drive was abandoned. I remembered the warnings of friends never to walk alone at night on an empty street. I crossed 108th Street back to Broadway, and as I did, the moon came into view as round as the Buddha's lotus face. It appeared like magic in a sliver of sky, framed by towering skyscrapers. It seemed as though the moon and I were traveling in the same direction. The full moon of October. My mother was with me. No doubt she had followed me to the temple as the moon was first peeking over the horizon. As I listened to the sermon and then to Kimioto's music, the moon shone on the temple roof and it followed me home. My mother died 6 years ago on the full moon day of October. The midnight moon is as gentle and wondrous as a mother's love. For the first 4 years after she died, I felt like an orphan. Then one night she came to me in a dream, and from that moment on, I no longer felt her death as a loss. I understood she had never died, that my sorrow was based on an illusion. She appeared in my dream on an April night when I was still living in the central highlands of Vietnam. She looked the same as always, and I spoke to her quite naturally, without a tinge of grief. I had dreamed about her many times before, but those dreams did not have the same impact on me as that night. When I woke up, my mind was at peace. I realized that my mother's birth and death were concepts, not truth. The reality of my mother was beyond birth or death. She did not exist because of birth, nor cease to exist because of death. I saw that being and non-being are not separate. That night about 1 a.m. I awoke and my grief was gone. I saw that the idea that I had lost my mother was only an idea. Being able to see my mother in my dream, I realized that I could see my mother everywhere. When I stepped into the garden flooded with soft moonlight, I experienced the light as my mother's presence. It was not just a thought. I could really see my mother everywhere, all the time. So he's just 36 years old when he's writing this. You see what poetic sensibilities he's got. So the genesis of this talk came from my friend Jerry Smith, one of the members of our Sangha. Jerry, bow to you. Jerry sent me this week. It's called Seeing All Beings as Your Teacher. Picture or imagine that this earth is filled with millions of teachers, Buddhas, wise beings. Imagine that every single being you encounter is enlightened, except for one, yourself. Imagine that they are all here to teach you. Whoever you encounter is acting as they do for your benefit, to provide just the teachings and difficulties you need in order to awaken perfect patience, equanimity, courage, compassion, and love. See what lessons they each offer you. You have a lot to learn about love and presence, tolerance and courage from each encounter with them. Honor each as a teacher, and inwardly thank them for this. Take a day or a week to notice the enlightened teachers all around. Notice how it changes your whole perspective on life. So the great teacher is life itself, of course. And it really helps to have a teacher, a Thich Nhat Hanh, who can point the way of practice so that we can begin to experience each person we meet, each moment, as our teacher. You know, that great poem of Rumi, The Guest House, where he says, you know, whatever comes into your house, a meanness, a joy, you know, an irritation, greet them all with open arms. Same idea. So the great teacher is life, but not life as an abstraction, you know, capital L life, but in the minute particulars of life. Jack Kornfield would say, you know, when he was a young monk in Vietnam, that they were taught to bow to everything. You know, they would bow to the Buddha statues, they would bow to their teachers, they would bow to the food, they would bow to the latrine, you know, they would bow to everything. And it's the same idea, incarnated in a physical motion of acknowledging the Buddha field, the Buddha nature that is within all things. That's why we bow to each other here. Everything has Buddha nature. Everything is our teacher. But knowing this in the marrow of our bones, that requires a different level of consciousness, what I was talking about last week if you were here. So, you know, lots of skillful means, lots of different ways to drop into this different level of consciousness. I've talked any number of times about this practice that I really like of dropping the mind into the heart and simply seeing through the heart. I was at the dentist this afternoon before going to the gym and coming here. You know, when you're in the dentist chair, really about all you can do is count your breaths, you know, and just hope it doesn't hurt too much the next thing they're going to do. Really, meditation is useful to have in the dentist chair. But it was interesting to, just play with seeing the hygienist from the heart. Seeing my friend Bob Elam, my dentist, who's my great friend Roy Elam's brother. See Bob from the heart. Your dentist as your teacher, whoever thought, you know. So I've told you this before. Kathy, I had this morning intention that she would say, after we had done our sitting every morning, she would say, "May I receive whatever this day brings. May all the circumstances of my life serve the awakening of wisdom and compassion. May I receive whatever this day brings. May all these events of this day be my teachers. May they serve to awaken wisdom and compassion." So, tomorrow morning, early, I'm going to fly out to California and be with my teacher at Spirit Rock, Philip Moffitt. And I'll be back for this next Wednesday, so I'll be back here and I'll tell you about the retreat. It's really important to find a teacher. Several teachers. I have, you know, several teachers. Christian, Buddhist, Jewish. But it's really important to find a teacher, and it's important to be in your teacher's physical presence. You know, Paloma Kane and I are going to be leading this retreat at St. Mary's in Suwannee, October 20th through 22nd, and it's a real opportunity to be with the teaching and with the teachers in a little bit more extended way than we can do here on a Wednesday. So St. Mary Suwannee, and then Rami Shapiro and I are going to be teaching the first weekend in December. Our topic is going to be birthing the Christ within. So here's a Jewish rabbi and an Episcopal priest talking about birthing the Christ within. And then in October of 2018, Rami and I are going to lead a tour to Israel, and we'll be working the same territory of not just exploring the geography of Israel, but the inner geography of the Christ consciousness. That's what I'm most interested in. So find a teacher. There's so many great teachers that are available to us now. DharmaSeed.org is a great resource for hearing great Dharma talks. DharmaSeed.org. My teachers, Tara Brock and Guy Armstrong and Jack Kornfield and James Baraz and Sylvia Borstein, Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Amaro, all these folks have scores, hundreds of Dharma talks. They're worth your exploring. So that's it for a little bit. So I think we'll end tonight with two little gathas of Thich Nhat Hanh's, two little verses that he teaches. Breathing in, I know that I am breathing in. Breathing out, I know that I am breathing out. And we simply repeat to ourselves, in, out. In and out. Breathing in, my breath goes deep. Breathing out, my breath goes slow. Breathing in, deep. Breathing out, slow. Breathing in, I calm my body. Breathing out, I ease my mind. Breathing in, calm. Breathing out, ease. Breathing in, the Buddha smile comes to the corners of my mouth. Breathing out, I release all tension. Breathing in, smile. Breathing out, release. Breathing in, I know this present moment. Breathing out is the only moment. Present moment, only moment. I have arrived. I am home in the here and the now. I am solid. I am free. In the infinite, I dwell. So since I'll be away this Sunday, there won't be a meeting of the meditation and inquiry group at my home, but we'll begin again the next Sunday. I'll be back next Wednesday. Thank you, as always, for your presence, for your kind attention, for your generosity and baskets and support online. Have a great week. See you next week.